My name is Tommy Andrews and welcome to the SoundSpring podcast. This is the place where creative musicians share the ways in which they turn their stories, ideas, and feelings into sound. During each episode, my guest composers will take you on a guided journey through one of their musical works. This is music, straight from the source. Hello listeners and welcome to episode 19, featuring the whistle and flute virtuoso and composer Brian Finnegan. When I first heard Brian's music back in 2015, I immediately fell in love with his playing and writing, and his recordings have been part of my staple musical diet ever since. After releasing his first solo album in 1993, Brian and three others founded the Anglo-Irish group Fluke, which for over 25 years has been winning awards and gaining a substantial international fan base with their playful and dazzling take on traditional folk music. Another band, Can, was formed from four of the world's most influential traditional musicians and recorded one album, Sleeper, which is one of the most virtuosic albums I've ever heard. As well as being on the cutting edge of traditional music with his own groups, Brian also works regularly as a session musician. He has spent the last decade touring Russia and the Far East with Russian rock group Aquarium, and has recorded alongside musical titans such as Fairport Convention and Ed Sheeran. I can't quite express how excited I am to welcome Brian onto the show. When I received a message from him agreeing to come on board, I ran down the stairs and started jumping around the living room, much to my wife's confusion. So, without further ado, here is the maestro, Brian Finnegan. Brian, thank you so much for joining me on the show. You're one of my absolute musical heroes, and I am so excited to be talking to you today. So thank you ever so much for taking the time.
Oh, you're very welcome, Tommy. It's great to be here. Very happy to talk to you.
So I was first put onto your music when I was on tour with this jazz septet, the Tom Green septet, and we were driving through, I think at the time, we were driving through the Scottish Highlands, and someone said, oh, we should put on some folk music, you know, just to kind of, you know, it feel like we're setting the scene a bit. And one of the guys said, I'll put on some Fluke. And so we put on some Fluke. And from that moment on, I've just been completely in love with your playing and your writing. And your music has just, it's been with me ever since. I listen to it all the time. It's been with me on loads of adventures. And I just want to say thank you, firstly, for all of your musical gifts to the world. So thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. That's praise indeed. Sometimes I think you're reaching half a century old. It's lovely to hear, you know, musicians that I admire, other good players coming back. It kind of, you know, that it's landing in the right place when you get that sort of feedback. So I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I really want to congratulate you on your latest album called Hunger of the Skin. And this album would have been an incredible achievement, even regardless of our current situation. But you've managed to craft this during the crisis with musicians from all over the world. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the story behind the title. And was there a particular kind of catalyst that inspired you to embark upon this project?
February 2020, I had just played a lovely gig in Seville with a friend of mine called Sean Oga Graham from Portland on, and I'd worked a little bit with Sean Oga over the years in different incarnations, it was touch and go whether that gig would happen. The storm clouds were already starting to roll in from the east, and it ended up, we went out to Seville, but, you know, days after our return, as with everyone else, you know, the full scale of what was approaching crashed down on top of us. And I was faced, like everyone else, with that situation of gigs being either rescheduled or cancelled or dismissed altogether. So there was a bit of a wobble early on, and then followed quite quickly by a sense of calm and a prompt to make space to play and to practice. Actually, first and foremost, to practice. You know, and out of that daily nightly ritual of practice, I started to find that I was able to process and sink down into this deep vein of writing that I had been curious about for quite a few years. I've been on the road now, you know, most of my adult life, so I'd kind of convinced myself that I operated and I functioned better creatively when I was on the move. March last year, I had kind of reevaluate all of, it was a nice comfort for me to think that way, that I operated better when I was away. But reality was that it soon became apparent that I was much more creative when I was grounded in the same place every night. And the title was kind of born out of sense of the album was just born out of the sense of, you know, when you've got kids, you know yourself, it's last March and the month that came afterward, trying to make sense out of this situation that we were faced with that was just very, very hard to understand, you know, and to help me find meaning so that I could in turn, you know, make sense of it myself and then pass it on to the kids while their granny was driving by, why, you know, I couldn't put a hand on my old neighbor's shoulder, stuff like that, you know. I did what I always do, really. I find that over the years, it's in time of, you know, those emergency or peril that I'm best able to articulate those vast and immeasurable feelings through the form of music. So I just I took myself off every night and started to write. And Hunger of the Skin was just a reference to that state of being that we were all finding ourselves in, you know, cut off, isolated, swept out of each other's arms, each other's lives.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Now, you're really well known for your kind of genre-defying approach to traditional Irish music, but I find that this album pushes that even more. I find it even more diverse and even more exploratory. And I was wondering, were these qualities something that you were consciously striving for, or did this kind of happen just as a byproduct of this kind of creative surge that you felt?
I think a couple of two reasons. Well, one was I found that a lot of the writing that was coming last March was surprised me almost in its defiance. I guess I was just hopping into this feeling that, you know, it was looking out at the artistic community around me, the community that I grew up in and loved and moved through. It was just seemed so unfair that it wasn't there anymore all of a sudden. You know, people were really struggling right across, you know, poets, dancers, crew, theatres. And it seemed to be that it was able for life to continue quite okay without the creative, you know. And it made me think back to, you know, my early school and wondering where music fitted in, because whenever I had kind of already decided, I guess, early on that I wanted to be, involved in some capacity in music, I was almost like I was a bit of a weirdo, you know. It was the Skivers, you know. It was like there's like a few Skivers. There's one, a guy who wants to paint and a guy that wants to play music for a living, and I always felt that, you know, the sciences were, you know, our education, the way that we teach our kids is all really based on this scientific approach to education, and it reaffirmed to me how, you know, unjust that was, that the creative was yet again just dropped all of a sudden and it wasn't really important. So I kind of think a lot of the music that was coming was me venting the feeling of how unfair that felt. It wasn't self-pity, you know, I wasn't thinking of feeling sorry for myself, because I was kind of, you know, personally I was, my glass was more than half full, because I was enjoying this amazing chance to be at home with the kids.
Yeah.
But I guess that's what music is, isn't it? Music is, it's just, you know, it's for you first and foremost, but then it's heading out there into the world. And so I think the music was just passing through, and it was a little bit defined and jagged and dissonant. A lot of people said that they know my tunes because there's a certain signature in them, a certain patterns, but these tunes even surprised me because they were slightly different. They were meaner. They had more grit about them. So and to be honest, I was really enjoying that.
Yeah.
You know, I just was so absorbed in the process, and being still every night, I was able to, you know, go fishing in deep water.
Now, I do quite a bit of education, and I'm sure you've done some as well. And I'm really interested to hear a little bit more about how traditional music was taught to you when you were growing up. Like, for example, did you have one-to-one lessons, or is it taught in more of a group setting? Can you enlighten me a bit about that? I'm just really interested.
Yeah, no, I went to an amazing school. It was a class here, local class in the town of Armagh, called the Armagh Pipers Club. And a husband and wife, the Vallely family, Brian and Ethna, and they started the Armagh Pipers Club 55 years ago. And they just had this very unique approach to teaching traditional music. You know, Ethna was from Donegal. She, you know, music was in her family DNA. And Brian was an amazing, he's one of the Ireland's greatest living artists at the minute. So everything culturally rich at that time was going through them. And you know, we have this organization over here in Ireland called Cultus Cultureirin. And there's normally a Cultus branch in every town in Ireland, but because the Pipers Club were here 55 years ago, it seemed to be that they, you know, that this was the real rich place to go and learn traditional music. So rather than take the kids to Katy or to Blackwater Town or to, you know, Dungannon, you know, we all went to the Pipers Club. And it was, for the first year or 2 years, it was the tin whistle. So most kids would have started on a whistle. And I guess that was really just, you know, to see if there was, if music caught fire in a youngster. You know, it's like there was, you know, traditional instruments, pipes and concertinas cost a fortune. You know, so we played whistle, and it was a small group, one night a week, with either Ethna or Brian teaching tunes. A little bit about ornamentation, but we were learning a little bit by ear and a little bit from the whistle. They learned to play the tin whistle book for the Pipers Club. But the emphasis was very strongly on learning by ear. So and that's kind of how it started for me. You know, I was totally at odds for a little while. There wasn't music in the house. I was always a bit jealous of friends who grew up in musical families, you know, but a great love and desire for it that they spotted the wee fire and took me under their wing.
And when you were growing up, so you're in these classes, you were learning these traditional tunes, a bit of ornamentation, a bit of notation as well. Were you also encouraged to write your own music and do a bit of your own, maybe improvising and being creative? Or was it quite sort of straight down the middle?
It wasn't, no, we weren't encouraged to do any of that early on. I mean, I had a feeling from very, you know, in my, I'd say 11 or 12, that this feeling of trust and faith from both Brian and Ethna, that, you know, that it was in me and that, you know, I should have a go and I shouldn't be afraid of, you know, trying something that wasn't, you know, I had the rules, but don't be afraid to bend them, you know, learn them first, of course, but then, you know, don't be afraid to go out and enjoy yourself in whatever shape that takes. So I kind of, it, but it wasn't until I'd say my mid-teens that I started to hear wee kind of motifs of music that I didn't recognize. You know, the Irish tradition is so rich and so deep and so ancient that there's a kind of almost a genuflecting towards this vast repertoire of tunes, and so it, you know, you subconsciously absorb that reverence when you're learning as a kid. And so when I started to hear this music that wasn't anything that I was learning in the Pipers Club, you know, it was a long fermentation before I realized that it was coming from me. And then an equally amount of time of you know, trepidation and fear, as you know, I can't possibly be a writer, or I can't, you know, my tune wouldn't stand up, wouldn't be worthy enough. All the kind of angst, I guess, that any young musician would be, you know, faced with, you know, that self-doubt. But there's something, you know, it's a very powerful force of nature when it catches fire, and it just wouldn't leave, you know, it wouldn't go away until I wrote it down, and then it still wouldn't leave me alone until I played it for someone else. And then that's kind of how it started for me. You know, I realized that that this was around, and that I could catch it if I was in the right place at the right time. So, and that changed everything. You know, writing just it took me from, you know, enjoying music and the camaraderie and the social skills and stuff, into really thinking that it was a vocation, and that that's what I was born to do.
Now, a lot of your writing, especially for bands like Fluke and Can, and this latest album as well, is just full of so many different influences. And I was wondering, was there a particular point that you can remember where you consciously thought, right, I've got all this music that I love, and I really want to try and pair that with my traditional upbringing? And if that was the case and you did have that moment, what were the kind of things that you were trying to kind of shoehorn into your writing?
I think it was really when I started to make space to write. I think, you know, when you start to write, or when you start to make yourself an interesting place for a tune to land, I always have this kind of little thing about being a writer. I think of myself more like an antennae. You know, I think we're all little aerials, aren't we? And we're tuned into our own little frequency, and some people attract a certain kind of signal and some people. And I just I realized that I was just a particular lightning rod for this music that was coming, and it was I feel that it comes from nature, and it knows exactly what it's doing, and it knows exactly who it needs and who can carry it. And so I get the raw material, but I think that when I started to do that, when I started to write, all the other doors opened into other genres, because I think when you're writing, you're just improvising, you're making stuff up that wasn't there, you know, seconds before. And so when people say about, I was never afraid to improvise, because I thought, you know, I have the compass points, I know where I can tell where I am in a tune, as long as I know what key I'm in. And so by doing that, I kind of found that a lot of projects were coming to me that other people would have turned down, because, you know, cross genre jazz and rock and experimental music. And I said yes to it all, because I was interested in it, and I thought, you know, it's not going to make me, you know, what's the worst that could happen? I'll musically drown for a couple of days. But it somehow made me rounder when I came back to what I did. You know, not necessarily worse or any better, but for the experience, it broadened me. And it was all just the life journey that I needed to live to get to me to where I could write tunes that I'm writing right now, you know, to, with the influences and the colors, and, because I kind of ingest music You know, I've been playing in a rock band for the last 12 years out in Russia. And that had been pretty quiet in my writing until Hunger of the Skin, because I realized that I was still in, I was so close to the experience. You know, when you're in a big life journey, it's very hard. I mean, it's like looking at a huge Matisse work of art, you know, with your nose pressed up to the canvas. You know, you just don't see it. And so it was only whenever the dust settled at the beginning of last year that I realized I had a decade of all of this influence that, and this kind of rocky stuff that, and the, so it's in answer to your question, that's a kind of a very sprawling answer, but I think that nothing's premeditated in my music. I'm not that clever. I think I can spot in someone when they're trying to, in the kind of whole that genre of fusion, I think if you try too hard, it's pretty obvious that that's what you're trying to do. It has to be a very organic and, you know, it's just about osmosis, I suppose. You know, when you live it, then you're qualified to talk about it.
You mentioned nature, and during this crisis, I mean, I'm massively into nature, and I have been since I was a kid. And I've heard from a lot of people that during this crisis, they've been able to connect slightly more with nature again. And I was wondering if maybe you'd had a similar similar experience during the crisis, and whether this affected your writing as well, especially being in the same place and getting to stay there for all the seasons of the year.
Yeah, massively so. No, I live in the countryside, just outside of Armagh, and we've just got wild open space in every direction, you know. I grew up in a family before music. There was running and fell running. My father was a fell runner, mountain runner. So we had a very kind of unorthodox childhood. We spent most either at feshes and flat hills, or stuck up the side of a misty hill at the weekend, you know. So, and I picked up on his almost mystic love of mountains and wild space. Last year, that was the thing that was most remarkable to me, was that I always kind of dipped. I realized that, you know, for the last 20, 30 years, I've been in and out of the cyclical nature of seasons. You know, I'm gone and I'm back and I'm forth, and I'm one minute I'm in the frozen tundra out in Siberia, and then I'm back to, you know, like late spring in the garden at home, and everything's a jungle. And so it was a real blessing last year just to be at home and to watch the seasons come and go, and to live it from the inside, you know. So I guess that also, it brought a hush to me that enabled me to close out the clatter and all the noise, to welcome this, the new music in. So I think, you know, nature is, for me on all my life, I always felt that Irish music, and the atmosphere and the cry or the song in Irish music came from the turf. It came out of the mountains and out of the lakes and so in the rivers.
Yeah.
So I agree. I think music comes from nature to me, and I have to be in the right place. I have to be in tune with the cycles of it, and in the flow of it, and thus the title of the track.
Yeah. So the track that we're going to be talking about is called Flow, in the year of, I might pronounce this wrong, but Wu Wei, one of those two. Wu Wei. Can you tell us a little bit about the significance behind this title?
I think, well, Wu Wei is the old Taoist philosophy of actionless action, you know, of being in a in a rhythm or having a momentum that you know you can't control. You know, it's there's something happening around you that is it's outside of your control, and you know that you can either get anxious about it, or you can just find your own. You can tread gently through it. It's almost a letting go. You know, it's instead of grasping to something, you just let it go and let it flow. So the flow in the year of Wu, I kind of thought that this, you know, again with the kids, you know, I was like, there was either you could get caught up in listening every night to what was happening in the world, and it was extraordinary circumstances for everyone, you know. But I quickly realized that there was nothing I could do about it. You know, I couldn't open the doors of the theater, and I couldn't hang out and make music with the people that I wanted to, and so I just I settled in and thought to myself, rather than get anxious about it, maybe this is the year that, you know, all the music was just waiting for, because now you're still and now you're at home, and now you can really you know, keep your word. And so I kind of, the flow in the year of Wu Wei was a reference to letting go. My granny had a great line. She used to say that if you, the bird of paradise will not land on the hand that grasps. I remember saying it to me whenever I was a little kid. You know, if you're trying to grasp something too tightly, it's the chances are that it'll never come near you. So I kind of, that in her own sort of kind of mystical way, she kind of nailed this year for me.
Piece starts off in this kind of relatively pared down lineup, and I was wondering, when you came to write this tune, did you just hear it in this kind of pared down lineup, or did you actually picture the whole thing and hear what was to come, or did it start off as more of a kind of typical traditional kind of setup?
No, it's I still find it very, thinking back to that first, there was a kind of rush of writing, I suppose in the middle of March, and I think the first tune in Flow was the first piece that, it was an A part, and it came quite quick, and then I thought it was slightly Breton sounding, and then a couple of nights later the B part arrived, and as is all quite often the case with me, I'll catch a piece, either an A or a B, and if the other, you know, its kindred spirit doesn't come quite quickly, I'll just leave it alone, because I know now that if I try to chase it down the wormhole, I'll break the spell somehow. It's not ready. So I just kind of left it alone, and then a couple of nights later there was a B part, and I realized they went together. But from that moment on, it was like every night I could tell that something was brewing. And I was still too absorbed in the writing of the tunes, of the parts, to realize that they were all connected. It was a kind of crazy ride, because normally when I'm writing a tune, I can hear the symphony. You know, I can see the chords, I can feel the vibe and the push and the rhythm and the syncopation and stuff, but I don't exactly know how to articulate it. I trust the great players that I have around me to be able to understand exactly what it needs. But with this one, it was even more, the scope was enormous, you know, and I found myself quite quickly after getting each tune, thinking there's space in this. There's space in every one of these tunes for something else. You know, yeah. It doesn't have to be, you know, they don't have to be back to back. You know, there can be, you know, I think as I said at the start, for this album, the music was just in charge. And it was like sensory overload. I was getting the tunes, and then I was, the personality of a musician would suddenly just come in my mind, and I'd say, that's exactly what that tune needs. Reach out to them, and it just caught fire from there. So
yeah,
if I had written Flow down on paper, I'd have been locked up. People would have thought, are you crazy? You know, how could that even work? You know, like a drum solo and a trombone solo and a Russian rapper in a piece that's 7 minutes long, because like, who is ever going to play it on the radio? And none of these things were important at the time, because as I say, I was too absorbed. I was too caught up in what was going on and loving every second.
For the first couple of minutes, so during, as you said, it was the first tune. We hear it a couple of times, but I was wondering how do you change maybe the way you're playing it, and also the way you've arranged it to keep things, you know, in going in a direction, keeping us going on the journey for the first couple of iterations of that tune.
It's kind of standard reel. I mean, it's a two part reel, A B B. Three times round, and there's a couple little variations, I guess, on the second and third time of the tune. I mean, whistle variations, and it's a build. It's a kind of slow build. I'm a big fan of Breton music, and you know, I have a lot of friends who are Breton musicians, and so I think that, as I said earlier on, when I first heard the A part of that tune, I thought it sounded quite Breton. So it was a kind of fest-noz, late-night Breton dance vibe to it. And Breton music isn't hugely ambidextrous to play. You know, it's quite, you know, it's more about the dance. It's more about the feeling of, you know, being in your movement and having a momentum. And I kind of think that's what that tune was about. It was just getting warmed up for the rest of the set.
When you sent out the parts to all of your guests, how prescriptive were the parts, or did you actually just kind of send out, earlier you mentioned the phrase raw material, did you kind of send out your more raw ideas and then just waited to see what came back?
Well, I have two people, two of the guys on the band, Sean Oak Graham and Liam Bradley, and nothing really went out until those two guys had constructed. You know, once Sean Oak was down on the track, and once Liam was down on the track, then the way became clear quite quickly, you know, because the chords were all, the colour and the atmosphere was there. So I sent, you know, I had sent the other kind of unique thing about last year was that, you know, I've spent a lot of time in studios and paid absolutely no attention to what was going on around me. I think, like a lot of musicians, you know, you just expect that there are other qualified expert, you know, people with expertise in the studio, and you take for granted that it's always there. And then, like a lot of my friends, you know, we were kind of educating ourselves on how to record at home, you know, and buying the kit and finding the dead space in the house. So all my early whistle takes were all done at home here in the broom cupboard, the laundry cupboard, and then sent to Sean Oak, So it was all remote. There were like the no two players were in the same space at the same time.
Yeah.
And it was a challenge, but I think once, as I say, once I would get the part to Sean Hoag, who, you know, the man can do no wrong. He's my favorite player at the moment. And he just hears things the way that I hear them. He's written them, you know. It's almost like he was there when they were created. So quick is he to get on the vibe and to feel the pulse. And likewise, Liam Bradley, the drummer, he plays in the Russian band with me. We've been on the road for 11 years, so I've kind of had a ringside seat. And I know that, you know, pound for pound, he's probably my favorite drummer. So when those two musicians were on each track, and they're on each track, it was the spine was already there. So the rest was just a lovely luxury of, you know, knowing who to reach out to, and knowing that, you know, if it had been any other year, half of those guys would have been far too busy to play on this record. So it was extraordinary in that sense, you know, that, you know, I got to choose some of my favorite players, and they were there.
After the first tune, we reached this kind of, I guess, a transitional section, which I really like, because, again, we drop down to this kind of thinner texture, and the theme suddenly becomes really kind of lighthearted. It almost, for me, it almost feels like a bit of a palate cleanser, because what's coming later is, it kind of gets slightly darker. As you were saying, gets a bit grittier. And we don't hear from this section again. So I was wondering, did this section have that kind of purpose in your mind? Were you thinking, oh, I need to just have something to separate these two tunes? Or was it something that you'd worked on and you just wanted to include it somewhere? Just wondering what this section was all about.
You know, that section, sorry, I have a very creaky seat here and a very sore knee. I'm trying to stretch out. That section in between the first tune and the second tune was that just it came out of nowhere one night. I was just playing around with kind of riffs, and then I got on to that little motif, and I played it around a few times, and I liked where it was sitting. This album was technically it was pretty hard to play. That was the other thing that was unusual to me, because there was a lot of half-holing, you know, and I play various different whistles. But yeah, I was, you know, even on one of my favorite keyed whistles is the F. And so it was like even within the six holes, so the ABC, it was asking me to play G sharps and fingered F naturals and stuff. And that little riff was based around a fingered F natural, and so I just went with it. You know, I liked where it was going, and then at the very end, just before it hits the second tune, there's everything drops to just the whistle playing that, and I'd kind of been listening to quite a lot of Snarky Puppy, and I thought that, you know, and Wolfpack, I thought that was like, it was a kind of moment where, you know, things just dropped, and there was just that little motif that it was just in. That was your kind of springboard into the second tune.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, I'm glad you went on to that stuff about talking about things that you maybe hadn't played before, technical things, because when I listen to this, I mean, I've listened to your music for so long now, and when I listened to this album, it just felt like there was something different about your playing, something that you hadn't necessarily channeled before. And did this happen just kind of naturally, something that you went with, or were you kind of thinking, right, I want to try some of these new techniques?
I think it was all born from a place of being practiced, because I, you know, when you're doing gigs every night, you become a particular shape as a musician, your gig shape, and you know how to pick your way around the set, and you can do it with blindfold, you know, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're sharp. You know, and I'd listened to a few things that I'd done over the last few years and not been particularly enamored with my playing, you know, and thought, you know, I can do much better than that. And then, you know, I was just too busy to put the time aside to practice and, you know, always on the move. So really at the start of last year, my main agenda was really to practice. And I thought, now's the perfect time, you know. And it meant that I was practicing, you know, 3 or 4 hours a night. And then the writing started. And by the time the tunes had kind of revealed themselves, I was actually fit to play them. You know, I found that for the first time in quite a long time, I was going into the studio and I was, I knew I could deliver the tunes, and I wouldn't, you know, that was one less thing to worry about. I was thinking, you know, I'm not stretching myself, even though they're difficult tunes. I've now, both my finger technique and my tongue and are, kind of, they're in the zone. So I was in much better shape to play.
There's something about your music that I've always found really life-affirming and really powerful. But again, there's something about this album that I feel like emotionally the communication is even stronger. Like there's even less, you know, there's no barrier between the listener and what you are communicating. And I was wondering, at the point of writing, were you also finding that you were even more emotion-led in your artistry than before?
It was a combination of many things, but as a writer, I really believe that your true loyalty is to not diluting, or how could you say, you know, I don't dilute or to the purity, the distilled song or the distilled tune or the distilled moment that comes to you, you know, or for fear that it, you know, it may be inaccessible or not popular, or people might not like it, you know. It's your true loyalty is to the inner vision, however it comes. And I found that, you know, after 50 years and watching my kids been born, and I came through it, you know, quite turbulent couple of years, you know, 5-6 years ago, where I kind of had to surrender and let go of a lot of old stuff. And then I hadn't really kind of looked at it again until the start of last year. So I think there was, for me, last year was about setting down the ego and quite tapping into a lot of soul. Because I think that, you know, your ego is who you think you are, but your soul is really who you are. And I was just in a moment when I'd lived a life that was ready to write the music that I wanted to talk from the heart, you know, and I didn't think that I was letting the music write the rules for me, but behind it was kind of quite a lot of life. So even though the pandemic was the catalyst to do it, there's like 12 years of stuff that, and quite a roller coaster there that went into making that album.
Слово становится плоть, плоть становится пыль, и губы сжигает страх пустоты. правильный летний секс. Здесь, в конце тропы. Господи, кто есть ли?
Was there a particular catalyst that drove you to choose to have spoken word on the album?
Well, my sister Mona is a great poet, and on The Ravishing Genius of Bones, there's I referenced the title of that album from a poem that she had written called Thomas, and she's quite a remarkable woman. She's an anthropologist, but she's always had this lifelong gift for writing beautiful poetry. I was a musician and she was a poet. But she's never really pushed herself, and her anthropology came along, and even when she became she did her PhD in hunter gatherers, and she went off to the Congo, and even her thesis was full of prose.
Yeah.
And I kept saying to her, you've got to write more poetry, you've got to get a collection together, and it was always on the long arm. And then absolutely serendipitously, while I was writing the music for this album, I just by chance got sent a YouTube video of Mona giving a lecture, an online lecture, which was called Touch. And it just blew my mind that, she was speaking about exactly the same sentiment that the music that I was writing had.
Yeah.
It was all about, how we've somehow been, we've kind of convinced ourselves that, the virtual is, and the brain is the most important thing, that as long as we've got, social media and this way of communicating and connecting, then we can have, shared dreams and shared shared experience. When really, it's not the case, because a virtual hug is not a hug, and it's not a salve for the emptiness in the air around us. And if it was, why is there so many people who are lonely at the moment? So it was kind of the way that she narrated her lecture was really beautifully spot on. Mm. And so I got in contact and I said, listen, have you any poems that you've written recently? Because I want you on this album, and I don't just want the text, I want you to say it. And so it was a bit of a tug of war for a while, but I convinced her, and then when she sent me Dir, I kind of thought that was pretty much the whole album was contained in what I wanted to say was in that one poem. So
earlier you mentioned Sean Oak doing some hand claps, and this is where we get to this lovely section where we've got the kind of the 4/3 rhythmic thing comes in, and the hand claps come in under the trombone solo. Did this kind of flamenco influence come about because you guys were in Seville just before your writing process?
Yeah, it did, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it was a lovely reference from Sean Oak, but it wasn't my suggestion. I'd given him the piece, and then we'd gone out to Seville a few days early, and our agent had taken us to this very famous flamenco festival, in the south of Spain, quite close to Valencia and or Seville, and we just spent a couple of really brilliant days just hanging out and going to late night flamenco bars and getting to know a lot of the kind of hand clapping rhythms, because hand clappers in flamenco music are just as important as the guitarist and often the dancer. It's really in the hand, the rhythms. And we kind of joked about it at the time and said, listen, we should get your man to guest on the next album, because there was a local character, and he was always there, and he was he was the life and soul of the party. You know, then suddenly when Sean Oak sent back his parts, there was, to be honest, I thought what a great moment. But I thought he'd sampled them. You know, I thought there was, he grabbed a sample from some sound library somewhere, but I didn't realize they were his. And until the very end, when I was crediting him for all the things, and he says, "And there's the matter of the hand claps," I was like, "Was that you?" Yeah. So, yeah, the 4/3 thing was quite a moment. Yeah. I'm glad that you were waiting for that to come. That's nice to know.
So after your, I guess what I would call the second tune, that returns after the trombone solo and the kind of drum break. And then we get this breakdown section, which is almost like the kind of breakdown section you'd get in a rock band before the final big chorus. And it really feels like it's building towards something kind of familiar. But then you completely caught me off guard. You throw in this big kind of heavy, dense, majestic theme with almost a kind of Chinese atmosphere to it. Is this kind of your nod to the Wu Wei kind of Taoist thinking?
Yeah, in a way it is. Yeah, I kind of, the narrative of that, of flow, for me, when I look back at it again, you know, when I was writing it, I was too close to it and involved emotionally. But when I look back now as a piece, I realize it's a kind of reflection of how I felt this year went. it started off, you know, you kind of, I think the piece starts off familiar. It's, you know, and then it slowly, it starts to disintegrate, and then it descends into dissonance and disarray and a little bit of chaos, and it's very visceral and defiant, and then there's a kind of surrender in there as well.
Yeah.
And I think that the end passage is that we've passed through, because even storms get tired.
Mm.
You know, and I think that the ending is arriving at an unfamiliar shore, but it's okay that you've somehow, we've held on to this thread. And any creative person will tell you that as long as you hold on to the thread, you know, whatever comes, it'll keep you steady and it'll hold you steady. And, you know, people will come and people will go, but don't let go of that thread. So I think that thread was running right through Flow in the Year of Wu Wei, but when it did come to the end, it was a feeling of a cathartic, you know, hope that we would be okay, that there was, you know, we'd arrived on a new shore. And yeah, the reference, I think it was a Chinese harp. Again,
okay. Yeah.
Again, played by Sean Oak. That was the nod to Wu Wei. So that was very well spotted.
So even though we as musicians were restricted in so many ways, do you actually think that there were aspects of the journey you took on this album that you'll now take on into some of your next projects, even when we're maybe back to slightly more normality?
I'm not sure. You know, I think that there's quite a lot of this last year will just become symbolic of this year. I don't know. You know, I think that, I mean, all the gigs that I had that were cancelled with Fluke, we had a full diary because we just brought out an album in 2019.
Yeah.
So all those gigs have been rescheduled. I don't really have any plans to play Hunger of the Skin live until, you know, it's rehearsed up and I've got the right people with me. And I'm quite happy just to let that go for a little while and see, you know, what arrives, because there are so many variables at the moment with, like, booking in tours, and, you know, there's a gridlock of tours, you know, and it's, I don't know if there's the space or even just, like, the resources to do it right, because I would want to do it right if I was going to do it at all. Experience in producing, because I've sat in on producing most of the Fluke stuff and the Can stuff, and, you know, I took a much more active role in on this one, and Sean Hogan and I produced a lovely album for an Irish singer called Gráinne Holland before we started work on Hunger of the Skin. So I think that relationship will develop, because I'd like to work with him more. And
yeah.
So I think it's exciting. You know, I want to keep, you know, I know that when it comes to making a living and, you know, there's a certain rhythm to the gigs that I do and the bands that I love playing all the music that you know, the various different projects that I'm involved in, but this has definitely set me alight.
Now, every guest I've had on the show, I've asked them a few quick-fire questions at the end, and I find this bit really exciting because we get to learn a bit more about you and the kind of your inner wisdom, but also there's a couple of fun ones in there as well. So, I was wondering, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
The best piece of advice? I've been given a lot of advice. I would say the best piece of advice was probably, I played in a particular Fla Cuil years and years ago, and I was a big fan of Matt Molloy, who's the flute player in the Chieftains. I'd go as far as to say I was his fanboy number one, and I'd kind of learned all of his repertoire, and I decided that I was going to play his tunes, and I'd qualified, and I was full of technique and gusto and bravado, and I went and I played in the final of the flute and played all of his tunes. Anyway, I didn't place at all, and I was a very learned old adjudicator. I called me back at the end of the competition, and he said to me, "Listen, you've got everything. You've got lots of technique, but that wasn't you that was playing today. That was, you know who you and I both know who that was. And so take this cassette away and have a wee listen to it, and don't forget that just be yourself. Have a go. There's no wrong way to play music. It's all an adventure, but you have to be yourself." And it wasn't for 6 months or a year later that I put this cassette in a tape recorder and I switched it on. The first track was Roland Kirk, and then there was Harry Prasad Shirazier, and then there was a couple of Robert Plant numbers, King Crimson. I couldn't believe that this old guy from Connemara had given me this cassette. He was like, he played in the North Connemara style. He played button box, you know, polkas and slides, and it kind of,
yeah.
That was both his words, and then subsequently the cassette of music was, yeah, have a go.
And through your experience, what do you think you would say to someone? What would be a piece of advice you would give to someone who is just starting their first forays into creative music?
I would say that if you're, you know, trust whatever kind of mysterious and invisible force inside you that has compelled you to even get to the start of such a journey? Like, if you're in music and you're just starting out and you have a big dream to play music, whatever got you there got you there for a reason. So you have to trust that, you know, you're not on a building site, you're not in teaching, you're not doing a degree. You're there because there's something wild and vast is guiding you into that world, and you really have to steady yourself and trust that it's the life for you, and know that every knock and every speed bump along the way is going to build your character, because there's no fast way to become a rounded, accomplished musician. With a life in music, you have to take it slow and steady, and take the rough with the smooth, and the rough with the smooth then starts to distill into your personality. It becomes who you are, but it doesn't, you're not just, you know, it's you don't just inherit it, or you're not just entitled to it. You have to earn your stripes.
Yeah. Can you pinpoint a particular musical moment that gives you the biggest rush of emotion or goosebumps?
God, you know, there's been so many great gigs over the years. I mean, I'm sure it's one of those questions, isn't it, for any musician? I'd say there was a couple of moments. I mean, I remember doing playing at Ortigueira Folk Festival in Galicia with the band Can in must have been 2013, I think. And we were over with a bigger band called Dawn. It was a project, three different bands from Ireland and a Scottish singer. And it was quite considered music, and we were the main draw. Dawn were the Ortigueira Festival is this unparalleled folk music festival in Galicia, where it kind of kicks off every night at midnight, and it finishes, you know, at dawn, 6 or 7 in the morning. And if you're lucky, you could be on stage at 2, half 2 or 3. But if you're not lucky, you know, you can, you know, you're competing against the local cockerel. And it's quite an experience. And Dawn were the main attraction. But by way of Can being involved, we were asked to go on first and open the festival. And actually, opening Ortigueira is the best slot, because everybody's reasonably sober at 12 o'clock.
Yeah.
Or half 12 at night. And it was just one of those, those moments, you know, when, everything, all the gigs, it all clicked in the same moment. And it was a very potent hour of music when everything went right, and we had done a lot of gigs together, and Dawn had not, and Dawn was, and I can imagine big band, concept band, where Can were a hard working band, and we'd made an album, and we were ready for that gig, and it was ready for us, and the crowd were ready too. And there's a lovely expression, I think Tom Waits talks about it, when I think he came from classical music, maybe, when he says we all went out to the meadow last night, and it was when you're in a moment, when you become formless, and there are no walls and there is no roof, you're not inside anymore, you've just collectively drifted out into the meadow, and you can't do it on your own, so you don't go out into the meadow on your own, you all have to go out together. And I think that gig was, I don't remember much about it, I just know that we were all in the meadow.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with my band at this tiny little jazz venue in London, where the audience are just right in your face, and you just feel like the whole thing's really, you feel like you're part of the audience as well, you're kind of right on top of them, and we were all kind of firing on all cylinders. And there was this moment where for a while I can't even remember it, like you're saying, I can't remember being there or anything. And then there was a section of music coming up that was incredibly difficult. And I found it almost impossible to kind of snap out of this big improvised section and come in with this suddenly with this sort of crazy odd time signature thing. And just like snapping into the real world after being in the meadow, as you say, it's really hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And that's why a lot of people spend their lives looking for the meadow. You know, it's like, but I think that, you know, when you experience those moments of intense white light, you know that you can't stay there for very long. It's like, I suppose It was like, if you got dropped out of a helicopter at the top of Mount Everest, you'd be dead. You'd be, you know, suffocated in a couple of minutes, you know, but you'd have to acclimatize to get in there. But it's kind of how you conduct yourself when you come back down. You know, it's those moments that you can't stay in them because they're too blinding and they're too intense, but they make all the other moments, it's all relative after that. You know that they're there and they're quite close, and some nights it catches fire and you get a taste of it, and then you start, you know, you start leaning towards it. So, and that's, you know, that's why I you know, there are, especially for the last year, there's been quite a lot of talk about musicians having to find another job and retrain and, you know, to, I don't know, get real with this world that we live in and love, and the whole creative arts. And when I hear that, I just, you know, it makes my it troubles me deeply, because I think you don't know, you don't get it. What it's like to live in that moment, you know, when you're weightless and formless.
Yeah.
You can't retrain. That isn't about training or study technique.
Now, you can ask one composer anything. By composer, I mean creative musician. Who would it be, and what would you ask?
My father bought me an album years and years ago, and it was a whistle player. His name was Tom McHale, and he died when he was a young man. He'd won the All-Ireland Senior Tin Whistle Competition, and he brought out this album of music, and it was so unique because he introduces each track on the album, and there's this big booming voice that at the start of every track, you know, so he'll say, "Two Jukes, the Cash Jug and Tom McFadden's," and then he just plays this whistle, and it's unaccompanied, it's just tin whistle, and then the next track, and again the boom voice, "Three Hornpipes." Yeah, and I was just, you know, my dad was a builder, he was a bricklayer, and, you know, we had this complicated new record player come cassette player that he never knew how to work it, and I'd get, you know, a tap on the shoulder late at night. I'd be fast asleep, and he'd say, "Come on, can you help me work this record player?" So I'd have to get up, and then we'd sit there in the dark, you know, listening to this, to Tom McHale's album, and somehow the kind of timbre in that voice, and the story that, you know, it stayed with me for years, and I know he wasn't a composer, but I wished I could, spend a night in his company and ask him about his life. I just loved his playing. He was a huge influence on my early playing.
Now, you can go to any concert, gig, rehearsal, session, musical happening in history. What would you go and witness?
Oh, wow. I think that if I could have gone to any gig, I would have been at, let me think. I think I'd have been at the Bothy Band live in Paris gig. That was in, I think it was in the Palais des Arts in Paris. I mean, and they made it into an album. I think it was like 1978. And the album and the footage of the performance is kind of music of the gods. You know, the Bothy Band were, for me, they were from another planet. You know, they were like, they harnessed the power of rock, and with this kind of magnificent wildness that just kind of went for the jugular, you know. And no, there'd never been anything like them. I mean, there'd been lots of bands who were mixing it up and who were, you know, experimenting in small ways with arrangements, but the Bothy Band were cool. You know, they just introduced a whole different level of cool. And for a young musician, I just, you know, and also a huge Matt Malloy fan, you know, and he was just in his pump. He was on fire in that band, you know. And I know that kind of by 1978, they were, the allure of other pastures had started to kind of slightly pull them away from that fixed star. You know, I think there were complications with management and financial stuff that was going on. But for 5 years, you know, they stood at the summit. And it's kind of hard to believe that, you know, where are we now? Yeah, in 3 years, they'll still be 50 years at the top of the summit. Because, you know, no one else has come close. There's been lots of other bands that have, you know, you know, followed in that way. But the Bothy Band were, I think it would have been just one of those moments when, like a lunar landing, if you know, and I'm kind of glad that they never reformed, you know, and for money and decided that they would, you know, take it out for a spin again, because I've seen a couple of those kind of reformations and I've always been left hoping that, wishing that they hadn't. You can't possibly be that hungry and have that kind of voltage 30 years after the horse has bolted the stable.
Yeah. Now, the last thing for me to say is just a huge thank you. You are one of my musical idols, and to have you on my show has just been such an honor. And I just want to thank you so, so much, not only for coming on the show, but also just for everything that you do. So thank you.
Oh, thanks a million, Tommy. No, it was really great. I'm delighted that you've asked me. It's a big honor to be involved in this great series, and hopefully we can get a tune one day soon.
That was the sensational Brian Finnegan. Next up, on the 22nd of June, I'll be speaking to the outrageously talented pianist and composer, Jennifer White. Jen is one of the most in-demand musical directors in the UK, having conducted dozens upon dozens of shows in the West End for television and recording sessions. Her gifts don't stop there, however, as Jen happens to be one of the finest orchestrators and composers I have ever had the pleasure to work with. We'll be speaking about Cosmic Odyssey, a beautiful piece from Jen's debut album for piano and orchestra. So tune in on the 22nd of June to be swept into the far reaches of outer space. See you there. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to keep in touch, visit us at soundspring.co.uk. You can connect with us on Instagram by searching for Soundspring Pod, or you can send us an email at soundspringpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. If you like what you've heard, please spread the word, and don't forget to give us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. It really helps us to reach new listeners. If you enjoy the show and want to support our podcast, you can donate or become a patron of the show at patreon.com/soundspringpodcast. Obviously, we encourage you to go and buy our guests' music. But once you've done that, and only once you've done that, you can also stream most of the music featured in the show by searching for the Soundspring podcast playlist in Spotify. And finally, I'd like to thank Katie Stevenson for her beautiful artwork. Please go and follow her work on social media by searching for Cub and Bloom. This is Tommy Andrews, signing off until next time.